Oh, thanks for inviting me to this. I've been looking forward to this since you told me about it. So, a couple things that I get to do today that I don't normally get to do. So first, I'm going to give you the full-blown, unadulterated version, unedited version of my talk, which I'm really excited to do. So normally, you know, I get this down to a 40-minute talk, and I have to gloss over certain nuances that I'm looking forward to talking about here. I'm going to cover a lot. I'm going to kind of go soup to nuts here on the technology that we developed, some of the things we found several years ago, and then bring you up to speed on the most current stuff with the tiling arrays and the microRNAs or non-coding RNA theoretical stuff that really Niklaus and I were most interested in talking about. Feel free to interact throughout. If I'm not making something clear, stop me and I'll try and go through it in more clarity if I can, okay? And for those of you who have heard some of this before, and I apologize, you'll be bored to tears, but I'll try and sex it up a little bit for you. So first I have to give my shameless plug to my institute. So I'm part of a new genomic center. New York, upstate New York, realized, I don't know, 5-6 years ago that they completely missed the boat on biotechnology for the size academic facilities they have in New York. They were getting their butts kicked by North Carolina and Texas and the California school system, that they really didn't take advantage of a lot of the technology that they had outside of maybe the city. So there's been a big push in New York to try and recruit technology-based research to try and get into the life science stuff, and I'm part of that initiative. That's our nice, bright, shining building. For those of you who don't know, Albany is the capital of New York. In New York, I don't think they know that. So I think when I gave this talk at NYU, I had people going, "It is?" Anyway, so... Yeah, exactly. Like, Albany? Where's Albany? So we're up about 2.5 hours north of New York City. This is the Hudson River right here, and this is actually the capital. It's an atypical-looking capital. And this, I'm part of the School of Public Health campus, which is over on an incubator site. So there is 14 small startup companies here, as well as some big ones. Taconic Farms is there, the mouse company, Albany Molecular, and Regeneron. So that's kind of cool. I mean, and I'm in an environment where they're encouraging this type of thing. All right, so that's the end of my shameless plug. I've done my required plug for the place. All right, gene expression predominantly in the world of molecular biologists who call themselves gene expression profilers or people who work on gene expression, they almost always use that term synonymously with transcription. So if I'm studying 100 genes and I say these 50 go up threefold, those 50 go down threefold, it's frequently assumed that's the result of a transcriptional change. I mean, I've even heard David Botstein say, well, of course it's transcription. There isn't anything else. It's just kind of a knee-jerk reflexive action that I think a lot of researchers take, that it's at the transcriptional level. And although in prokaryotic systems that's kind of true, it's not even true in prokaryotic systems. In eukaryotic systems, it's not true at all. Less than 50% of genes correlate at all at the protein expression level with transcriptional regulation. And that's because of all of these processing steps in between. So we've got the nucleus. After you get transcription, that message needs to be spliced frequently. It needs to be capped. It needs to be polyadenylated. It needs to be brought out of the nucleus. All of those things are very, very organized. And it pretty much, at least textbook-wise, it isn't taught that that's a very organized process. It is. Messages just don't go out of the nucleus. They are routed selectively out of certain pores, and some messages use some pores and other messages use other pores. And a lot of this we're just starting to understand at this point. Once the messages get out into the cytoplasm, lots of things happen. So the same message can have completely different half-lives in the same cell under two different conditions. So you can take the c-myc message, and it can have a half-life of less than 15 minutes, typically in the cell. But under certain cell cycle checkpoint times, it'll go up to about 2-3 hours, the half-life changes. So without making any more message whatsoever, what you've done is stabilize the message, and you get an appreciable increase in the amount of protein produced. Likewise, there's differences in localization. We were talking about the wound edge, and you can have the same molecule, beta-actin is one of the classic ones. beta-active message can be brought to the leading edge of a wound. Some molecules of beta-actin message and other molecules are retained more cytoplasmically for making of the infrastructure. So there's localization issues that we've only begun to understand. I mean, we don't even have the technology to really get at that yet. And likewise, there's translational differences. So the same message, anybody who's ever done a polyzone gradient here knows this, the same message can be translated at vastly different rates under different conditions. And this gets at some of the microRNA mechanisms for affecting translation. Same message, you get a net 2 copies of protein per copy of message under these conditions. Under different conditions or in a different cell type, tissue type, you can get 20 copies of protein per copy of message. So everything I've just said is basically to try to convince you that there's a lot of stuff happening after transcription that we really haven't begun to study nearly as well as we do as we understand transcriptional regulation and post-translational regulation. We understand a lot about glycosylation and phosphorylation and how you can turn a protein on and off. But regulation in here is poorly understood at best at this point. And so actually, when you look at a given protein and you say it's going up or down X amount, it's the sum total of all of these regulatory mechanisms that actually contribute to the amount of protein that you're seeing. And there isn't one thing that stands out. I mean, it's classic researchers that say, you know, I study the localization and therefore it's the most important thing. Or I study splicing and it's the most important aspect of regulation for this gene. Nothing can be further from the truth. It's all important and it's all a continuum. So it's much, much more complicated and it's combinatorial. So we're just getting started on this, and I'm making my shameless plugs for this, and obviously I'm big into the post-transcriptional gene regulation. All of this is being regulated by RNA binding proteins. Up until 3 or 4 years ago, I pretty much would say, so, it's RNA, what's going to be doing the regulating? RNA binding proteins. And about 4 or 5 years ago, I had to change that to also include now non-coding RNAs. So non-coding RNAs and RNA binding proteins are responsible for doing this regulation. And I think a subtle point here that's worth noting is the message as a message in the cell is transient, and therefore it's a commodity that's ideally suited for putting regulatory information in. The DNA is hardwired. You really can't mess with the DNA, and the protein is your final product. But the message is transient in the cell. You can turn it over as much as you want and reuse it. So it's an ideal place to put regulatory information. And I think that actually is evolutionarily going to be proven out. All right, RNA binding proteins are to this world as transcription factors are to transcriptional regulation. So everything you know about chromatin immunoprecipitations and the studying of transcription factors for the identification of promoters, you can extrapolate to RNA binding proteins and the study of post-transcriptional regulation. Equally complex, maybe more so. There's between 2,000 and 3,000 expected RNA binding proteins in humans.
How many domains
are there? RNA binding domains? About 10 that are recognized. Flavors of RNA binding proteins. There's a couple of real big dominant ones. The RRM containing the RNA recognition motif and the KH domain are some of the bigger well-known ones. But there's at least 10, probably more than that, different RNA binding protein types.
Do all those domains occur in all the different eukaryotic families, plants?
Yes, and actually the architecture is kind of cool. They start with the ribosomal proteins are probably the most simple RNA binding domain. There's the 80 or so RNA binding proteins that interact with the ribosome. I'm going to come back to those later on. And they have a relatively simple structure. And then there's these more advanced or evolved ones. And so I think all the families are represented in phylogenetically, but I don't know how diverse they are and how robust they're represented. But actually, that's a good question. I should know the answer to that. I don't. The number of RNA binding proteins increases dramatically as you go up phylogenetically, dramatically, as does the non-coding space.
Again, just sure. In considering bacteria, you mentioned that
but it's not. It's not. So the attenuator system, and I'm going to come back to that. So it's not. It's just it doesn't have to deal with the nuclear membrane. So I think transcriptional regulation is a little tighter in prokaryotic systems, but even there, you've got the ribosome influencing translation, and they're connected, and it's not exclusive.
Well, I'm told by my Bacillus subtilis colleagues that probably half of the ribosomal protein in Bacillus in subtilis are regulated at the level of, well, after initiation of transcriptions.
So we're going to save that, and let me, because I'm going to talk a lot about ribosomal proteins. They're an interesting family, and especially in prokaryotic systems. So when I hit that point, let me come back to that and see what your thoughts are. So I started my foray into this when I was at Duke University with Jack Keane. My objective was to find the RNA targets or target for a small family of RNA binding proteins called the ALAV proteins or the WHO proteins. It stands for embryonic lethal abnormal vision. Protein discovered in fly, thought to be involved in neuronal development. That's what we were studying, was neuronal development. We thought this protein was very, very integrally involved with neuronal dendritic formation. There's this interesting problem with neurites, is in that they're huge, and you've got your nucleus over here, and you have a lot of action taking place out in the dendritic ends, and how does that information get from here to there? Well, it turns out the messages are sequestered out in the dendritic ends, and you get localized translation. And that's what apparently our proteins were doing. So we were trying to figure out what the message targets were for our protein. And we pretty quickly figured out that using subjective technologies like RT-PCR, we could find anything we wanted and exclude anything we wanted. I mean, you had your controls like beta-actin and GAPDH, and you had your positives like MYC. And so they were positive because we thought they were positive, and they were negative because we thought they should be negative. So you design your primers and you do your cycling. And so beta actin kept coming up positive, so we'd reduce the cycle number to try and get it negative, and see MYC, we would try and get positive. And so we quickly realized how subjective the technology was, that you had to know in advance what to look for, and that you could really mess with what your expected results were. And I don't mean that trivial. I mean, it was a good first-hand education for me in molecular biology, how biased you can be with respect to your data. And the reason I say that is because that's what drove us to look at a genomic approach. And I think that actually is the best use of genomic technology. And I routinely see it misused, where they'll do a whole genome search or some type of platform that gives them a whole genome readout. And then they focus right in on the stuff that they wanted to look at in the first place to prove whatever model it is that they're trying to prove. And they throw out all the interesting stuff to retell the story that they wanted to tell from the beginning. So our objective was to come up with a technology that would let us look objectively as possible at every possible message and ask, what are the RNA targets for this set of proteins that we're playing with? Turned out it really wasn't too complicated. So this is a cartoon version of what we did. It's very analogous to the chromatin IP, the chip stuff. So we're targeting RNA binding proteins, preferably in a complex in the cell. Part of the goal here was to retain the integrity of the protein-RNA interactions while they were interacting in the cell. So we're not trying to recreate those interactions artificially after we've lysed the cell. And we actually took a lot of measures to try and keep things intact. So you lyse the cell, then you try and capture the RNA binding protein RNA complexes using some method. We use precipitation, so we're using antibodies to our proteins. We've done tagged proteins. Most of the data I'm going to show you is non-tagged, but tagging works. You could do other types of partitioning steps. You could use sizing separation and other things. Again, we've used immunoprecipitation. You precipitate these out of the cell, then you do some type of high-throughput screen. SAGE, microarray, deep sequencing, whatever. At the time, arrays were the easy thing to do. And the idea is that if you summed up all of these, they would be additive up to the total. So the total is steady-state levels of RNA in the cell. And collectively, these should add up.
When you look at many RNA binding proteins, how many of those are exclusive to the cytokine?
It's a good question. Many are nuclear restricted, many more are cytoplasmic, and many of them go back and forth between. So there's a lot of nuclear proteins that do shuttle and spend some time out in the cytoplasm. We specifically made our method so that we get pretty much as much nuclear material as possible. We actually don't lyse the nuclei. I'll go into how we do it since you asked. It's a hypotonic lysis swelling. So the cell basically swells up, which loosens up the membranes. There's a little bit of membrane rupturing because of some of the surfactants we have in the solution. And then the cells are downhomogenized and frozen and thawed. So there's a freeze-thaw step, which rips the membranes up. Then there's a hard spin, and we basically squish out a lot of the nuclear material, but we don't squish out the DNA per se. So we can detect all the splicing machinery, no problem. The SNRPs, I can detect any and all of those. Histones, I don't really detect, nor do I really detect the DNA. So we've gotten a lot of the nuclear component, but it isn't a true cytoplasmic nuclear prep. We've done those. We have trouble with the nuclei. If I go after just nuclear proteins, so I do a cytoplasmic removal and I capture the nuclei, then pop those open, it winds up getting really soupy, and it makes the precipitations problematic. And so I wind up getting a much higher background when I do a specific nuclear prep. So we've stayed away from that as a result. But there's definitely some compartmentalization issues that we are having, that we do have trouble with, based on the question you were asking. There are issues, and it's cell by cell dependent. So cells like HeLAs that have a big, fat, nice cytoplasm, we get great material, really clean results. Monocytes are terrible. So depending on the cytoplasmic volume, the technique is better or worse.
And what are your independent controls? I mean, because you're doing quite massive.
Good question. I don't use control. No, I'm just kidding. We've come up with a neat set of controls because there isn't an ideal system. And I'm going to show you some data and I'll walk you through how we actually do the analysis. So I use the U1 protein, part of the U1 SNRP, the U170K protein binds the U1 snRNA. So this is the SNRP complex, which the U1 snRNA in eukaryotic systems is at least 1,000 times more abundant than any individual message in the cell. So I can precipitate SNRPs, basically, by going after a specific SNRP protein. Likewise, when I'm going after one of my other proteins, that's the negative control. So I can show I do not bring down the U1 RNA, even though it's 1,000 times more relevant than or abundant than an individual message. Vice versa, I can precipitate the U1 RNA via a specific protein and show I don't bring down the messages. We also use the histone stem loop. So we're going to talk a little bit about histone messages. So histone messages don't have poly-A tails. They're one of the atypical eukaryotic messages. Not all of them, but the vast majority of human histone messages don't have a poly-A tail. Instead, they have this cute little stem loop structure, and it's one of the more well-characterized regulatory elements that we have. There's a protein that binds it called the histone stem loop binding protein. We use that all the time as a control as well. For a message, we use that one as a control. So we use a messenger RNA binding protein as a known control as our control, and then we use the U1 RNA binding protein as kind of a negative control. It's a positive control for the technique, but it's a negative for message. Does that answer? A little bit about RNA binding proteins, just a little terminology. So you asked a little bit about motifs. So the largest family member is this RNA recognition motif family, and it is the seventh most abundant family of proteins in humans. So it's a pretty big family just itself, and like I said, there's at least 10 or 12 RNA families. There's probably more than that, but most of the some of them only have one or two members, but there's a good 10 at least strong, solid families. So the main point of this slide is I just want to get you some terminology. So RNA binding proteins, by and large, fall into a couple flavors. What I call specialized RNA binding proteins or generalized RNA binding proteins. Generalized RNA binding proteins are those that interact with a large spectrum of targets. So poly-A binding protein. It binds the poly-A tail on polyadenylated messages. In theory, that's 90% or greater of the message in the cell. Okay? So it's a general RNA binding protein. 4E is another one, EIF4E, that's the cap binding protein. This is the protein that binds the cap on the 5' end of the message. Same thing, it's a generalized binder. On the extreme other end are some of the proteins I just mentioned, like the ALAV-HU protein, stem loop binding protein, which is the one that interacts with the histone messages. So in theory, the most restricted specialized RNA binding protein would have a single target. We haven't found that. Typical specialized RNA binding protein has between 3 and 6% of the total species of message in the cell will be a target for a protein, as opposed to the generalized ones, which can be 90% of the species of the cell. Does that make sense? So we deal with a subset pretty typically. So this is just a schematic of what we call this ribonomic profiling. I've taken to calling it RIP-CHIP as of late, because I think it's useful to most people know what CHIP-CHIP is, and I can piggyback on the terminology and ribonomics. I don't know, I get beat up for using an omics, but you have to call it something, or somebody else calls it something, and then you don't get no credit for it. So again, isolating the complexes, some type of in-mass identification of your targets. And then the two things that I have really spent most of my time since leaving Jack's lab, and what I'm most interested in, are these two. So there's two things going on here. Firstly, again, using transcription factors as my example, here's a set of genes that are regulated by some shared transcription factor. The assumption is that there's some motif in there, some common promoter that this transcription factor is identifying. And there's a whole bunch of people doing work, informatic work, to identify the promoters. Likewise, there's reason to believe when I pull out 700 different messages from a cell lysate with a given RNA binding protein, there's reason for me to believe that there's some common element, at least in some of those, that my RNA binding protein is interacting with. It's a much more complicated problem. So unlike DNA, which is fairly rigid and limited with structure, RNA, you have to deal with structure. And I'm going to show you some of the things that we've identified or that we think exist. Much, much more complicated. Most of the RNA targets are conformationally dependent as well as sequence dependent.
Are the ones that bind double-stranded RNA, or most of them?
The double-stranded RNA binding proteins are actually the minority. There are some, but they're actually not a very robust family set. They're interesting. There's some really sexy ones. But I actually think those are primordial transcription factors, or vice versa. I won't be at all surprised if there are transcription factors that actually moonlight as RNA binding proteins or have been misannotated, or and vice versa, that double-stranded RNA binding proteins may actually be professional transcription factors and vice versa. I mean, in the end, yeah, double-stranded RNA binding protein pretty much is looking at DNA. I mean, it's a little different, but it's not that different. But most of the single-stranded RNA binding proteins, they'll interact, and I'll show you some of these structures, they'll interact with a couple of sequences in space that have to be separated frequently by a stem of a certain size. So it's the physical positioning of 4 or 5 nucleotides in space. And so they're almost impossible to identify right now with the informatic tools that we have. Once you know, so you can identify them empirically by bashing every sequence, and then once you know it, you can go backwards and identify these. But if you didn't know what to look for, they're almost impossible to find. And the phylogenetic conservation is kind of cool, because the stems don't have to be phylogenetically conserved. They just have to be the right size. But there's some issues of double mutations, and we can talk about that if you're ready. Because you'd have to get a compensatory mutation on both sides. But you got to remember that G's and U's can base pair an RNA. So last is this functional relationship, and I'm going to talk about this first. So this was the first real major significant observation we made when we used a genomic approach to this question. We found, first of all, that there was a set of messages, not one message, but a set of messages being regulated, and there were some examples where there was clearly a functional relationship amongst the proteins produced by those messages. And I'll show you some more of that. And thus began a real search for, well, why are these being regulated as a group in the functional relationship? So when I say MRMP, this is what I mean. Well, I de-mic myself here. So I don't actually know what these things look like. I'd love to know at some point. But these are messenger RNA protein complexes. This is a cartoon guess of what we may be dealing with, and I'll point out some caveats that I can't rule out at this point. So here's my message. Here's some generalized RNA binding proteins like 4E, the cap binding protein. Here's poly-A binding protein. Here's a non-RNA binding protein that is bound indirectly. So this is the 4F complex. So this is RNA bound via protein-protein interactions. So I can target this. I've done this. I precipitated this guy, and I can bring down message. Okay? But it also points out that I definitely can get indirect binding, and that's an issue. So I can be targeting one RNA binding protein, be asking, okay, here's the messages that come down. I can't rule out indirect associations with other things. In fact, I assume that does happen at some degree. And here's a specialized RNA binding protein like my ALAV protein bound to a specific sequence. And so I can target this, I can target this, and I can target this. And this is the data for that type of an experiment. So this is one of our earlier experiments. I like this figure because this is a macro array, but visually you can see my point much better than the high-density AFI arrays, which really don't say much when you look at them. Pre-bleed. So another control we use is just an antibody to, it's actually to a bacteriophage protein, so just a background negative control antibody for non-specific binding to the beads. So this is a pre-bleed. This is my specific ALAV protein. This is the cap binding protein, poly A binding protein, and the total. And you can see subsets, but the point of this is not only the subsets, the way we do our analysis is relative abundance. So everything is measured relative to everything else. And so an example of that are these two here. So let me back up a little bit. These are double spotted clone tech nylon arrays. You use radioisotope labeled probes. And the reason they're, you see two spots, is they're double spotted down. So as an example, here's two genes. Beta actin is A, the message for beta actin. Ribosomal protein S29, the message that encodes that is B. And you would look in the total RNA and you'd say there's about equal abundance of those two. They're about equal. In this precipitation, the beta actin is enriched relative to that message. Vice versa in poly-A binding protein. The S29 message is enriched, you can't even see it, it's cut off, relative to the beta actin. And they're about equal in the 4E. So we actually do that on a global scale. So we don't do our relative enrichment to one message. We do it to all of the messages on the array. So we take the intensity of all of these divided by the number of positives, and the same here, and you're looking at any individual message relative to the whole. So it's a global normalization. It's not perfect, but it's the best that we have so far on how to do this. It works well when you're comparing apples to apples. So when you've got 1,000 positives and 1,000 positives, it works. It gets problematic when you start trying to compare a pellet profile to a whole profile. And we can talk about that. I'm always looking for better ways to do the analysis.
So just so I understand, so the 4E is a cap binding
protein? Yep.
So in theory, 4E and PA/VP should be the same.
In theory. So what do you think about that?
4E, you're just not efficient in bringing it down.
So for those of you who don't know what 4E, it's a really good question. I'm glad you asked it because it shows at least you were listening. So it's a subtle observation that's pretty astute. So cap binding protein binds the cap, and all the messages are supposed to be cap. The poly-A binding protein binds the poly-A tail. All these messages have a tail. Why don't they look the same? I don't have a great answer to that, but I have a partial answer to it. So it turns out that the whole purpose of the cap and the tail, we believe, is to allow circularization of the message, so that the tail and the head come together, bridged by a series of proteins. And what happens as a result of that is that the ribosomes are back at the beginning when they get done with the translation, so that they're reutilized and you get much more efficient translation. So that's a regulatory step. So if you don't do that, this is an example of where you get two copies of protein per message, plus the message is now susceptible to degradation. Circularize it, you may get 20 ribosomes loaded, so you get 20 copies per message. Okay. The antibody that we were using binds an epitope on the 4E protein that is masked, we think, when it circularizes. So we think we only precipitated, or we were biased to precipitating linearized message, which is pretty cool. So we've tried to compare that profile to a polysome gradient, and it looks similar. So it actually, it points out a subtle but really relevant point that we even can tap into subtleties like that. Depending on which antibody you're using, you may or may not be seeing real representation of the total population.
But you're saying, so because linearized is not being translated, right?
It's not as, yep.
So you could simply do some restrooms since you have.
So what we did was polysome gradient. So we do polysome gradient, and you take the light fraction, which is the non-actively translated, and the heavy fraction, which is the actively translated, and we run the microarray. And the light fraction looks like this. So that this is the linearized fraction. Circularized is being translated. So you could look at the protein. I'm sorry? It could be blocked. Yep, yep. So yeah, we could look at the protein production of any of those messages and acts. Are they going? Is there appreciable or not? We didn't do that. We did a little bit of it, but it's an interesting question. And for that reason, we tend to use a minimum of two antibodies for each of our proteins, just for the reason that you pointed out. So when we do our precipitations, we tend to use more than one antibody and confirm that we're seeing the same thing. 4E, there isn't a lot of good antibodies against. Actually, it's not the easiest to precipitate. Good question, though. All right. I mentioned that this is a protein involved in neuronal differentiation. So these are preneuronal cells. You treat these cells with retinoic acid, and they differentiate to become neurons. When they do that, the target of messages interacting with our protein changes. So this is before retinoic acid treatment, after retinoic acid treatment, and here's an overlay, where red is fourfold enriched, blue is fourfold unenriched, and green is less than fourfold changed. And the important thing here is to say that it's dynamic, that as things change in the cell, the network of messages being targeted changes as well. And it doesn't always reflect perfectly what's happening with transcription, and that's what this shows down here. Where clearly, like IGF-2, it's not made, this is total, it's absent before retinoic acid treatment, present after retinoic acid treatment. Clearly you can't see it in your pellet because it wasn't made. So nothing exciting there. We're not really giving added information here. But these middle ones are the interesting ones. So integrin beta is present before and after retinoic acid treatment in total RNA, but really only comes down after treatment. So that suggests that there's a compartmentalization change. So you've got the message in the cell, you've got the protein in the cell, but they're not interacting until after treatment. I don't know whether that's because the protein physically has to change so that it can bind the message, or whether it's a compartmentalization restriction, which is what I think it actually is. So the message and the protein are not allowed to come into contact. And the reason I point that out is that is important for our technology. If we were doing synthetic RNA interactions with recombinant protein in a test tube, we wouldn't find this type of thing. We're actually looking at the real dynamics of interactions in the cell, not what can interact, but what is interacting. All right. Sure. Yep. Yep. And we're going to get to that. So what Nikolaos is just saying, I mean, I was assuming it's compartmentalization. You got your RNA, you got your protein, but they're not coming together. There may be other things preventing that interaction. They may actually be sitting right next to each other, but the regulatory element that RNA binding protein needs to interact with may be masked. And that's the newest data that we have, and we'll talk about that at the end. So, where do RNA binding proteins interact? The vast majority of what we know about these cis regulatory elements, that they exist in non-coding region. They can exist in coding region, there's a few examples, but that tends to be evolutionarily difficult. So the RNA needs to serve both coding function as well as regulatory function. That's difficult, but it can be done. Most of this information occurs in the 3' UTRs, which are about 2,000 bases on average in humans. Or in the 5' UTR, 200 to 300 bases in humans, or in introns. So there's a lot of expressed sequence space that is non-coding, much more than is coding. Most messages contain a lot more non-coding RNA than they do coding RNA. And that's where we think most of these exist. So here's a very simple version of part of an element. So most RNA binding proteins have multiple domains. This is the target for one domain of a protein that has three domains. So actually what's being recognized is much, much more complicated than this. There's several of these, actually thought to be five, spread out in the message over in space and some secondary structure that we have no idea about. But this is the target for this ALAV protein that I've been talking about. In a CELEX reaction, which is where you take synthetic RNA and recombinant protein and you interact them and then you amplify and you do round after round, This was the putative target site. So it's an AUUUAUUUA. It's an AU-rich element. We looked in the 3' UTRs of the messages that were interacting with our protein after neuronal differentiation. Again, this protein's involved in that process. And sure enough, there are ample examples of what could be a nice AU-rich element. And they're overrepresented in these 3' UTRs. That doesn't mean that this is the binding site. But this is a very simplistic informatic approach to trying to identify these binding sites or regulatory elements. But this is much more typical. So this is a similar experiment done with Steve Warren's lab in Emory. The target protein in this case is the protein involved in Fragile X mental retardation. It's called FMR. We did the precipitations along with their group. This is actually out of brain lysate from knockout animals and wild-type animals. We compared the data. This is AFI data, and this is what I meant by doesn't really mean much. A lot of spots, a lot less spots. Then we looked at the top 80 winners, top 80 messages that were enriched fourfold or greater. And 90% of them have this structure. So this is called a G-chair or G-quartet. And this was found, it's a long story, I won't go into it here, but it was found by accident. It really wasn't found informatically. They had reason to believe that these existed because the polymerase that was being used in the PCR reaction kept stalling out, which is a real hint that there's this type of structure that forms. The point of this is that I just, for informaticists, I just wanted to point out how complicated this is. How you would informatically find something like this when the actual binding area is this GG right here, this GG here, and this GG here. That's where we think the protein is actually interacting. And so what you're looking for is a couple of Gs, and I mean, that's impossible to find informatically. You have to know the structural context. It's a cool structure. Again, it's called a G quartet. You've got interactions spatially with the G's actually can base pair more than just your typical Watson-Crick base pairing, and they actually form this chair or stack structure where these are interacting like this. So this actually flips over, so it's a long stem that is actually bent over and stabilized by this ring of G's. It actually can exist in DNA too. It was pretty strong when it first came out. Now there's some, it looks like FMR may have, the protein itself may have, so it's like all RNA binding protein, not all, but most, there's multiple domains. And this protein actually has several domains. One of its domains looks like it's interacting with this, but the other domain, which may be more relevant to the disease, it's called a KH domain, isn't interacting. It's a kissing chair or something like that they think it's interacting with. So it's actually a big controversy in the field right now as to whether this is actually what's being bound or not. It's not trivial to ascertain.
Some people have not mutated.
Yes, they have.
They have.
They have.
And then
it does affect binding. But it's hard to know. Again, you can imagine how you can affect downstream things pretty dramatically. A mutation here can result in secondary and tertiary structure being affected downstream. Again, it's a lot more complicated than DNA is. So we've done a lot of RNA binding proteins, 25 or so, and I'm going to talk about one of them to give you a few take-home points, and then we'll move on to the sexier stuff here. So the one at the top is the LA protein. This was discovered a long time ago by Jack Keane, the guy I was working with at Duke. It's an autoantigen. It's known as a diagnostic marker of Sjögren's syndrome, so it's also known as SSB. It has a long history. It's known to be involved in 5S RNA processing and tRNA processing. So we wanted to know what it brought down as far as messages. We didn't even know if it did bind messages, let alone if it bound anything interesting. So this was the most interesting set of messages that we had precipitated to date. So you actually can probably see it in this room. It's all the ribosomal protein genes. Every single one of them, as well as some other translational machinery. So it brought down all of the messages responsible essentially for making the ribosome and translation. So nothing was as strikingly obvious functional relationship in our hands. Partly that's because we almost exclusively worked on human, and the annotation in human genome sucks. So, you know, every gene has like 10 different names, and it's hard to know exactly what it does. So the annotation in the ribosomal protein genes was one of the few unified or uniform annotated human families, and so this kind of jumped out a little easier for us. Yep, what that means. I have some thoughts, but all right. So, for those of you who may or may not remember your bacterial genetics, or if you never took it, so you were mentioning back there B subtilis there. So, fortunately, I didn't sleep in my genetics class the day they were talking about this. But so I remembered that the ribosomal protein genes in prokaryotic organisms are organized into a cluster of operons, which are actually jointly regulated in a regulon. So how are they done in humans? So this is the chromosomal architecture of the human 80 or so ribosomal genes as well as pseudogenes. You can see they're kind of all over the place. There's some organization in some cases, but not much. It looks like they're pretty randomly distributed in the genome. So from this was born the first big take-home conceptual point that I want to make. And this was probably the most significant stuff to come from our work. So we came up with this model for post-transcriptional operons based on what a classical operon does. So here's the point. Classical operon, we've got, let's say, four open reading frames, polycistronic architecture. You make the one long transcript. It gets translated as a group. Wonderfully and highly efficient organization. Beautiful. So let's say the ribosomal protein genes, we're making a ribosome. The problem with this architecture, Jack and I argued, is multifunctionality is impossible. It comes at a real premium. So if I wanted the product from open reading frame 2 to be used in something else in the cell, I have to make the other three products wastefully. So I can use everything once in its architecture as it's been assembled in a polycistronic system. Only once. If I need to use it for something else, I have to make the rest of the stuff wastefully, which is why only about 50% of the genes in a prokaryotic system are probably organized in operons. They're not all. Correct. And I would argue that the ribosomal protein genes in prokaryotic systems are probably not used for anything other than making ribosomes.
Because, but I mean, along this argument that, you know, you cannot use it for something else, I think.
I agree.
So many around.
Sure, that you could just, you've got one over here, and so you agree. And again, these are just arguments. It's impossible to prove one way or the other. We were just guessing. So what we began to propose, and what I'm going to mention here, is that as organisms became more complex, higher eukaryotic organisms have dealt or made complexity not from increasing the number of genes, but from increasing the way in which the same set of genes can be mixed and matched. So multifunctionality becomes the most important thing, that you can use the same ingredient over and over and over in many other combinations. That's what gives complexity. So to achieve that in a higher evolutionary organism, what we suggested is this monocistronic architecture, which takes advantage of post-transcriptional regulation. Break these four out into four different messages and now bury in those messages regulatory elements that allow different RNA binding proteins to mix and match them in different combinations and regulate them as groups in different combinations. So in this case, RNA binding protein D recognizes a shared element in each of these messages so that they're still regulated and expressed as a group, translated as a group, recapitulating the ribosome. But because you can have combinations of different elements in both elements in the 5' and 3' UTRs as well as in the introns, you can mix and match them in very different ways, giving you completely different things that you can make.
What would be the evidence for combinatorial control in the
safety of 3'? What evidence would you like to see? I mean,
transcriptionally.
So the evidence is pretty parallel to the evidence for combinatorial control transcriptionally. It's similar, that you see multiple modules, nodes, that appear to be evolutionarily conserved and literally modular, added and deleted. And that, again, the field is way behind transcriptional research, but it's similar evidence. That
are the cases known of cooperative binding?
Cooperative binding from an RNA binding protein?
Yes.
Yeah, that's exactly what we are finding. And that's what our method shows.
But so how do you know that they're really cooperative rather than just additive?
I see what you're getting at. I don't. And I'm not exactly sure how I would. The true essence of combinatorial building of complexity is not trivial. I'm not exactly sure how I would show that verse additive. But it gets at the very end questions that I'm going to want to talk about, and kind of setting the stage for that is, and this was early when we wrote this paper, this was in Molecular Cell. It's actually the first hypothesis paper ever published in Molecular Cell. This begged the question, how does the cell know which element to use? So if there's more than one regulatory element, how does the cell know which element to use? So the idea here, like with beta actin being at the leading edge of a wound, as well as being translated over here for something else, for the cytoskeletal structure of the cell, the argument would be one regulatory element is being used for the set that's being recruited to the leading edge of a wound, and a different element is being used for the normal basal activity. Very beginning part of the field. I mean, we don't have a lot of evidence suggesting which those elements are, and then even less on how they're being used in a combinatorial manner as opposed to additive. It's a good question.
But is it actually the question of additive versus combinatorial?
I don't know exactly how I would even test that, let alone whether I have any data to support one side or the other. I've used the term combinatorial, but I think to be inclusive of additive. I won't be disappointed if it's just additive, I think. All right, so after we proposed this model, several groups, more or less, including our own, provided data to really support it nicely.
I didn't quite get the model in the sense that you have those circular mRNAs, right? And you have a common protein which binds to each of them. Do you have a picture that it localizes them nearby, or how could I make this mesh with the bacterial opera where the polymerase just,
So that's a great question. That's a great question. And before I get to it, let me answer partly what you were asking too, because it overlaps with what you were saying. You got to remember that technically, the way we do our procedure, we're precipitating with the antibody protein and the RNA that's complex to it. There's no way for me to know the heterogeneity or the homogeneity of those populations. So I could have a message right here that has one protein bound to it, and it's the only protein bound to it, and I'm pulling out that message. And another message over here could have a cadre of different proteins bound to it, one of which is the protein I'm targeting. I'm looking at them as the same thing, and this is part of that. It's hard for me to tease that apart at this point. And we're trying to do some stuff with Rob Singer where we actually can track simultaneously up to 11 messages as well as two proteins to ask, are they physically located in the same place in the cell, which gets at what you were saying. So one of the most important aspects of the classical operon is the co-translational information. So there's a whole bunch of cool operons that are like a cluster of outer membrane proteins that form some pore in the surface of the bacterial cell. Well, you've greatly facilitated the biochemistry behind organizing that multi-subunit structure because the proteins are being translated right next to each other. I mean, these are six proteins that have to assemble into some pore. Well, they're being translated right next to each other. They self-assemble. You've greatly increased the kinetics of molecular interactions. I would be very pleased to find that that's exactly, at least in part, what is happening, that you get co-translation as well as co-localization of the messages so that you facilitate or recapitulate really one of the best benefits of the classical post-transcriptional, classical operon, is that they're transcribed as a unit, they're translated as a unit, and they assemble. So I'm hoping that actually you do see co-translation, and that's actually in part what these guys show.
But still, the biophysical picture is that once one mRNA is finished being translated, then the ribosome hops on another, which is nearby.
That's that model, and again, it's a model, the circularized model of translation, and the idea is that you've increased efficiency of translation by recycling or recirculating the material involved in translation. As an aside, and I'll do it here, and I hope this isn't a distraction, intellectually I find it much more attractive, the idea of localized routing of messages as the way in which this is done. So you'd have regions of the cell that are high translation, medium translation, low translation. And you're actually routing the messages. So the same message, when it goes over here, you get one copy of protein per message. When it goes over there, you get 20 copies. And what you do is you have a lot more tRNA, a lot more ribosomes, and a lot less RNases here. So it's an area of high efficient translation. And over there, you have the opposite. Low tRNA, low ribosomes, and lots of RNases. Anything that goes down that track is only going to get translated pretty inefficiently. And so you've built the infrastructure, and now it's just a routing problem, as opposed to each message kind of being its own self-contained entity, and the ribosomes have to land on it and all of that. That makes some sense. So if you had 20 messages all being routed by the same RNA binding protein, normally they're going over here and they're not translated very efficiently. Different RNA binding protein interacts with them and brings them over here. The whole set gets rapidly and actively translated. So this is Pat Brown's group and Danny Hirschlag. Andre Gerber was the lead author on it. He's gone on to be he's a PI now as well. And so they did this in yeast, a nice, beautiful, elegant study. Tap tagged everything, and they went after five puff proteins. These are the puff RNA binding proteins. They precipitated each one, did whole genome arrays, and they found the most striking thing was this PUF3. 80% or more of the targeted messages associated with PUF3 were nuclear-encoded mitochondrial proteins. And it made a lot of sense. Again, it's the same with the ribosome. I mean, here's these proteins that you need in the mitochondria, right? Why would you take the messages and let them go out in the cytoplasm and get translated anywhere? Then you got to go get those proteins and bring them over to the mitochondria. What Pat Brown and Danny Hirschlag argued was that the whole set of messages are actually routed as a group out of the nucleus, actually right over to the mitochondria, where they get translated right outside the mitochondria and then get shunted in. So the same thing comes true with the ribosome. So ribosomal protein-ribosome interaction takes place in the nucleoli. I mean, ribosomes are assembled in the nucleoli. So you have to go translate 80 proteins out in the cytoplasm, bring those proteins back into the nucleus where the nascent ribosomal RNA is being made. There's 4 to 5 pieces of RNA depending on your organism. And you have to assemble this really giant macromolecule. And the ribosomal proteins are being used stoichiometrically. They're only one per ribosome. And during efficient translation, when there's efficient energy bursts in the cell and it's actively growing, upwards of 20% of the ATP in the cell is used to generate ribosomes. So it's a good example of, if the cell doesn't need ribosomes, it's not going to be wasting its time making ribosomes, and it likely uses a highly efficient way to track the protein production for the ribosome. So in this case, what we are arguing is that the set of messages encoding ribosomal proteins are brought out to the cytoplasm, the proteins are translated as a group, and then routed right back into the nucleus. And they found something similar with mitochondria. Okay?
You know, PUF3 has the same function in other organisms?
So other groups are looking at it. So the puffs are well conserved and
also the same thing, I think.
In Drosophila. Yep. And it's not quite. So what happens is, and they did the puffs. It's got a bigger set of things. I mean, I think what you're seeing is the lack of multifunctionality in lower organisms. And so these sets are very clean. As you get to the higher system, even in Drosophila, it wasn't as striking. They did find some flavors, but it was more complicated. And just like this, where you've got sets. And this is where it's lending itself to combinatorial, not additive, that there's multiple codes that you're tapping into what is a heterogeneous population. So in other words, there's a message that has a PUF4 code, a PUF3 code, and a PUF2 code in it. That message is represented in each of these. If that makes sense. So there's several other groups that have also shown data now to support this. There's, I think, about 6 groups that have shown data to support it, including Pam Silver's group at Harvard. All right, so let me segue into the tiling array stuff and try and get to the more exciting stuff. So several years ago, we started working with Affymetrix to look at the tiling array platform. Everybody know tiling arrays here? Does anybody not know tiling arrays? Everybody cool with it? Good. All right, then I won't go through it. pretty straightforward. You basically are exhaustively interrogating sequence space. You've got probes that tile some sequence of interest. Whole genome, whole chromosome, whatever. In my case, I'm using chromosome 21 and 22. So we're using tiling arrays to do three things. First, we are going to try and look at alternative splicing. I'll show you a little data of that. First, let me just show you the cartoon version. So probe sets, tiling across, in this case, a gene. We've got exon, intron. You've got what is called exonic painting, where if you take the RNA and you hybridize it to the tiling array, you get probe activity in and around the exon. You're supposed to not see it in the intron, you do. And you're supposed to not see it in the intergenic region, but you do. But this is in general why you use tiling arrays, is to see well-annotated RNA. Okay. What we're doing is adding, not only can I precipitate my RNA binding protein and ask what comes down, message-wise, we've added some fragmentation steps so that we can start to actually footprint the binding sites.
So can you explain why you're not supposed to, but you do?
I wish I could, but let me show you the data. So the answer to your question is that the human genome is much, much more active than we thought. It was assumed that you would only express the genic information, introns and everything would be processed, and you would only see essentially what we expected to see. The predictions are as much as an order of magnitude. I think that may be a bit high, but certainly 2 to 3-fold more RNA is expressed from our genome than we ever thought should be. Regions that there's no genes, there's no nothing, anything. There's all kinds of activity in introns. It looks like it's frequently coming from the other strand. What it means, I wish I had the answer for you. Half of the researchers think it's the most interesting thing since sliced bread and are loving it and are very excited, and the other half think it's crap. You know, it's just either a technical artifact or it's a biological artifact. You know, that it's expressed, but it's noise. That
it's not the non-specific hybridization.
Well, so that's the technical argument, is it's just non-specific binding, and it's a technical artifact of the technology. That it actually isn't expressed at all. It's garbage. Agreed. Yeah, I mean, the technical thing appears to be pretty well, but I still hear that argument. And then the other argument is that it's a lot of sloppy polymerase starting, that the polymerase hits some degree of frequency non-specifically, and you'll get these short little pieces made. And it's biological noise, but it's irrelevant. Again, I don't think that's the case, but the argument, it's still out. All right. Our foray into this is to show that we pick up the same material. So most of this has been done by looking at total RNA. Now I'm going to show you this stuff being trapped and networked by RNA binding proteins, which goes a long way to it not being garbage.
Sorry, just back to the previous slide. So if it's biological noise, if you just repeat the experiment, you get the same result. So it's
good point. I find it to be very reproducible, incredibly reproducible. But others find it to be... So first of all, the signal is lower. It's definitely lower, which by definition makes it harder to reproduce. But it is reproducible, at least in our hands. And Affymetrix has no problem reproducing it. But the groups that really don't buy it, that's one of their chief concerns, is that it's much more variable. Reproducible, identical experiments, split it into three parts and run three independent arrays, very reproducible. Three biological replicates, you see a lot more bouncing around. You know, same cells grown on one day, make your lysate, run a sample, next day do it again, next day do it again. So it may be much more dynamic, and that's partly why it's harder to capture. All right, so I'm going to talk about transfrags as the term for those of you who haven't played with tiling arrays much. Immediately you are confronted with the issue that these aren't necessarily genes, they're transcript fragments, and then you have to decide what your criteria are. So if you have two probes together and they're both positive, is that because one piece of RNA straddled them both, or they're two little pieces of RNA that were making them positive? You have to decide that. And so this is just a little cartoon version where these are the individual probes, this is their activity, and you've got an intensity threshold that you can raise or lower, and you can either allow for one to be negative in the proximity of positives, and then you wind up saying, okay, well, if these are both positive, above that line, call them together, call them one transcriptional fragment. So you can string these things together or keep them apart, depending on how high or low you raise or lower the stringency. The reason I point this out is I'm going to talk about transfrags, and this is a guess. You know, I don't know what to do or where to put this bar any better than you do. We don't even know if this stuff exists and it's real, so it's up to the end user to decide. We actually wind up using both a high stringency and low stringency. So we do everything in parallel with what we consider a low stringency cutoff and a high stringency cutoff. And we rarely see much of a difference qualitatively with anything. But this is where the field is kind of defining things as we go along. All right, so this is what some of the data looks like. So this is a gene, the TPTE gene. These are introns, exon, exon, intron. Four RNA binding proteins that we did. This is the ALAV protein up here, who are. This is a protein called IMP. The LA proteins that we were talking about before that bound the ribosomal protein messages, and poly A binding protein. This is transfrag activity in an intron. This is activity in and around an exon. When you go in and so tiling arrays, at least the ones I use, are not stranded. So you wind up doing a double-stranded labeling. And so I don't know which strand my signal is coming from. So you have to go in and you can design primers for both of the strands and then do PCR to confirm or refute which one it was from. Most of the time we do that on intronic ones. The activity appears to be coming from the other strand. I think it's real. It could be the digestion, but that's all done at the same time. I don't think it's a digestion issue. So let me show you some data. And this is more food for thought. You know, you can ask all the questions you like, and I encourage you to, but I'm not going to have nearly as many answers. I mean, I don't understand what's going on with a lot of this more than anyone else does. It's pretty much just cutting edge, and I don't know what a lot of it means. So the first thing that we found was that you can use this approach to identify interesting alternative splice preferences. So you have an RNA binding protein, and this is an RNA binding protein interacting with one alternative splice form and not another. And what's really cool about that is they're both present in the cell simultaneously. So there's all kinds of arrays out there and other methods for looking at alternative splicing, but you almost always have to have one form or the other. So you got two cell lines, and you've got one isoform in one cell line and a different in the other, and you can show those differences. But it's virtually impossible to tease apart multiple isoforms in the same lysate because one masks the other. In other words, if I've got this exon represented in the total, it will mask the fact that it gets skipped out in a small portion of the message in the cell. Okay, so if 20% of it is alternatively spliced and missing an exon, you can't typically see that because it gets masked by the 80%. But we can see it here. So this is my gene. This is with the LA protein. So LA interacts with the ribosomal protein messages. This is a ribosomal protein message. There's only one on chromosome 21-22. This is the L3 ribosomal protein gene. 10 exons. It's got some snow RNAs in it, which is pretty cool. This is the total RNA activity, the probe activity. Pretty nice exonic painting. This is my poly-A binding protein activity, transfrags. Again, pretty nice exonic painting. This is my LA. So I find an isoform associating with LA that is missing this internal exon. Despite the fact that the full-length form is present in both the total and in my poly-A binding protein. So there's multiple species of this message in the cell, and only one of them appears to be interacting with LA. I don't know what it means. I don't know why a ribosomal protein message would be alternatively spliced. That's a whole other story I'd love to talk about. I mean, I always thought ribosomes were homogeneous, and I don't think they are now. I think they're heterogeneous. But I just want to show the technology in that we can pull out isoforms out of a mixed population, and we actually went in and cloned it. Primers we made on either side of the exon boundary, and we found a truncated piece. This is predicted. So it's truncated. 40 amino acids would be pulled out and be put back in frame. So the osiform is really there. Whether it's expressed as protein, we don't have an answer yet. We're trying to determine that right now.
How do you think Lala recognizes this isotope?
It's a great question. I don't know. If anything, you'd expect there to be an added piece. You know, and it's the opposite. This gets at the three-dimensional stuff, though, is by removing this, change the structure in a way in which, and it's an internal thing. Law is actually supposed to bind the 5' extreme terminal track, is thought to be the binding site. It's called the 5' top sequence, terminal oligopyrimidine track. So I have no idea. Second, really astute question. I have no clue. That actually is thought to be part of the binding sequence up there. Come on. So that clone was from the Law precipitate. So we precipitate with Law and cloned it out of the RNA that came down with the Law. That's how we did it. All right, so this non-coding stuff. And I'm going to use the word non-coding and microRNA kind of back and forth, and I apologize for that. I don't know what these are. So again, this is what you're looking at, my four RNA binding proteins, genetic information here annotated, and then you'll see some other people's data, both Affymetrix data and Mike Schneider's Yale data. So, gene of interest. This is the Affy total RNA data. This is the Yale total RNA data. That's my data up top. Again, exonic painting, pretty nice. Occasionally you get this stuff like this in the middle of an intron. This is what I meant. I pick it up too. So I see this stuff. This is with Law, didn't find the others. A lot of what I see agrees with what you see in total, but I see things they don't see and they see things I don't see. So this is data in and around a gene. Here's my gene. Again, nice exonic painting, some nice agreement. There's nothing supposed to be out here. It's possible that the annotation's off, but they're picking up something and I'm picking up something. Same out here. There's nothing annotated there. So this is getting at that. We're picking up transcripts of RNA that shouldn't be there. For theirs?
Yeah.
This is a time course they did, and same here. They did a bunch. These are two massive experiments, one from Yale, one from Affy. I don't actually remember the details of it. So another example, there's nothing here. Right? So there's no known annotated information in this region of the genome. This is the activity in total, and that's what I pick up. So yeah, we're using our RNA binding proteins to start binning these into, you know, there's those that bind this protein, those that bind these two protein, these that bind neither protein, to start to make some sense of it and to start asking biological questions. But we back up now and segue into something. So when we first saw this, we thought we were directly interacting with these messages. All right, we are these non-coding RNAs. We thought, all right, we've got RNA binding proteins and we're interacting with these, physically interacting with these things. I don't think that's the case anymore. And the reason is this poly-A binding protein track. Okay? So when we look at something like this, this little piece of RNA, there's no poly-A tail on it. So I have no idea why poly-A binding protein would interact with it. What I actually think is happening is that my RNA binding proteins, like poly-A binding protein, is binding to a message via its poly-A tail. And bound to that message is non-coding RNA that we're picking up. And so this is the genomic coordinates for a piece of non-coding RNA that was bound to some message that was being networked by my RNA binding protein.
But then you should be able to sequence the messages bound and find out if it exists or where it comes from.
So what I can do is I can get the sequence of this, and I can get the sequence of my messages, and informatically I can ask, should this have interacted with it? Is that what you're asking? Yes, which is a great that's what I'm saying. Ziping and I, or whomever, would like to. It's not trivial because you have to take into account rules that may or may not be appropriate. So you can use the microRNA hybridization rules, but if that's not a piece of microRNA, if it's some new flavor that base pairs differently, But what you can do is seed elements and try and at least say, yes, we should, you know, we've got 100 messages, we've got 100 non-coding RNAs, what percentage could we argue could overlap? So, this sets the stage for the last part of what I'm going to talk about. First, let me just mention, so this is the grant that's going in. So in addition, we're using this footprinting stuff. So we enzymatically chew up the RNA before we precipitate it. So we do it with and without enzymatic digestion, and we can get this footprinting. It's still large. We still get, you know, we can footprint down to 400 to 600 bases. We can't really get the resolution much better than that. But we can start to say within this 400 or 600 base region, we think is the binding sites. Again, the problem is these cis-regulatory elements are conformational, and you could have one region here and 1,000 bases over another region in space, they come right together. I mean, there's a protein that binds tRNA in the cloverleaf structure of tRNA. Well, actually, these two arms of the cloverleaf come together, and the protein actually binds the two loops together. So sequentially, they're completely spread apart, but in space, they come right together. So that's an issue. But we're using this to footprint. All right, so like half my lab is informatic now, and as we've been going after trying to find these regulatory elements, so we've needed to develop more and more tools. And one of the proteins we've gone after, so this is the GW protein that we were talking about. So this started this business of, are we trapping non-coding RNAs? And what does that mean if we are? So this is a protein called GW182. Because it has a GW repeat in it, and it was discovered because of its patient sera. This is from an autoimmunologist up in Canada. There's this patient sera, and when you stain cells, they make this really big punctate little bodies. This was all discovered about 8 years ago, right around the time when microRNAs and P-bodies were being discovered, and it turns out that GW bodies and P-bodies are one and the same. So we precipitate this protein, and it turns out that this antibody, this patient sera, actually has Argonaut activity. This is the one that we're pulling down. So this is a messenger RNA readout. Now we're doing microRNA readout. So we precipitate the Argonaut complex, or we precipitate P-bodies, and ask, what are the microRNAs in those little granules? We're using a microRNA readout. We also can put those on tiling arrays, and you see a lot of other things, which suggests, again, you're actually capturing non-coding RNAs in the act of interacting with their target substrate. So we did the following experiment. So this sets the stage for the problem with our model, our post-transcriptional model. Part of the problem was you had multiple regulatory elements in a given message. And you had those multiple regulatory elements so that this message could be used multifunctionally. Oh, it's very much like cooking. You know, we want to use this ingredient with these six other things to make this in the cell. And then we want to use that same ingredient over here with 10 other things to make something else in the cell. And that information is being conveyed at the level of message. The protein's the same in each case, but it's in the message that information is conveyed. So how does the cell know when to use the message with these ingredients and when to use it over there with those ingredients? It sets up this problem of, how does the cell know which regulatory element to use? And so thus comes this idea that we, and I'll give you the take-home message and I'll walk you through the data, that it is, the cell is blanketed with non-coding RNAs whose job it is to regulate this code. That this code is, that the non-coding RNAs are masking and revealing a very complex and elegant secondary and tertiary structure in transcripts. And that's really what a lot of this non-coding RNA is doing, and that the microRNA field, this one very specialized function, the one where the non-coding RNAs bind and actually cause the message to be degraded, is just the tip of the iceberg. Now we've added to that the issue, the phenotype, where the non-coding RNA, when it base pairs in a slightly different way with the mismatch, you get translational inhibition. And I'm arguing that there's lots of flavors of non-coding RNAs. These 20 MERS may only be the beginning. There's 50 MERS. Actually, had that talk yesterday, I think those are 50 MERS that they're seeing. 55 MERS, I think. I know, but had you. I think that's what they're seeing. There's different sizes. And Kim, John had a 28 MER. What did he have that day when we were in NYU? that there's different flavors of these things, and we may not know, we may just be beginning to understand what they do. All right? So, I asked the following question of our informatic team. I've got these regulatory elements that RNA binding proteins are binding to. So I've got the cis regulatory element, my RNA binding protein is acting like a transacting factor. If you think about non-coding RNAs, certainly like the latter type that are involved in the microbes that are involved in suppressing translation, you can think of those as transacting RNAs. And the question is, are they reading the same code? So is it the same regulatory elements being targeted by both non-coding RNA and RNA binding proteins? So we did the following experiment. We were talking about the histone sequences before. So there aren't a lot of well-characterized regulatory elements in RNA. There's maybe 15 or 16, and we've cataloged them and we put them into sets. It's called the Tudor collection, the UAlbany training UTR collection, the Tudor collection. And in each of those sets is a family of messages, each of which contains at least one pre-identified element. So there's the histone stem loop containing element. They're the histone messages. It's 20 some odd messages. Each message has a little stem loop in it. Okay? So we made these so you can go build informatic tools for mining and finding these things and to assess noise. So we took that set. We made a control negative sequence set, not by scrambling, but by actually picking random pieces from the human genome. Based on GC conservation and size to represent our negative control set. We actually did that 10 times. Take our set of 20 some odd messages, each of which has a regulatory element in them, and then we blasted for microRNA targeting, not using PICTAR, which we should have, but using Miranda. And I think it was actually important that we not use as high astringency. So PICTAR doesn't find it as well. It kind of does. But I think the criteria is actually more stringent than would have allowed us to see this. Okay, so here's the idea. We've got a set of messages. We know where the element is in each of those messages, and it's the same element. And we're asking, of the known 300 or so microRNAs, do any of them target any of these messages? And if so, where do they hit? We did the same thing with our negative controls. Clear? So, they will either pile up at some central point where the regulatory element is, or they will randomly hit if they hit at all. So this is our negative controls. They randomly hit if they hit at all. And this is the histone elements. They actually, the microRNA, there's actually two families of microRNAs that we found that hit right at the regulatory element, directly at it.
Which one?
518 and 39. I got one of them right here. This is the 518C, and I think 319 is the other family. As an aside, so these are the human ones. We did the same thing with all known microRNAs, and there's one that binds even better, higher affinity for interaction. I shouldn't say bind, but has a higher affinity for interaction, and it is encoded by SV40. It's the SV40 large T microRNA, which is a whole other story we can talk about. So here's the coolest thing about this whole little exercise that we did is, so not only did this microRNA basically say, yes, there's an element right here. So here's the stem loop sequence. This is the one I was telling you about. It actually, this is the sequence that's important. This C is important. This C is important, and I think these two U's. The stem actually you can completely replace with any other stem. So but this is a little sequence. This, the stem loop binding protein binds right up here and it binds down there. MicroRNA is in black. And as you can see, the two are mutually exclusive. So if the microRNA were to interact with this sequence, it has to melt. The stem has to unfold, suggesting a potential switch. So in this case, the non-coding RNA would be basically turning this off. It would hide it. It would mask it. So, based on essentially no data, but a neat little idea, we propose the following flavors. So that this is how non-coding RNAs could modulate the cis regulatory code that RNA binding proteins bind to. We published this earlier this year in RNA Biology. These are the flavors we came up with. First flavor, some type of non-coding RNA actually stabilizes the structure. So you could imagine a stem here that's pretty loose. We got A's and T's down here, or A's and U's. And you actually need this to stabilize it. So it's a transacting RNA that acts in a positive way, again, like a operon. This would be an activator. So when this is present, it stabilizes the structure, and now you get an RNA binding protein to bind to it. This is what we had data for, which we're in the process of validating at the bench, where you've got a non-coding RNA that melts a structure. So this is a repressor. This is one of the cooler ones. So this would be a double-stranded RNA binding protein one, where you actually have a transacting non-coding RNA that, when it's in the process of binding, creates the binding site. Which we're working with people that have a double-stranded RNA binding protein involved in stem cell generation. And one of the problems with double-stranded RNA binding proteins, as simple as they should be for identifying their target sequence, because they're essentially transcription factors, they're really hard to find. And it may be because of this, that actually it requires a transacting RNA that, if you didn't know that, you would never find these things. You need to have that information. So we don't have any evidence for this one yet, but I find it a really attractive idea that it has to be created de novo. And the last one, and it's a complement of a couple of these, and it gets at the attenuator molecule, where, and this is what I like about this, the model, is that you could have multiple regulatory elements, all of which are connected to each other. So in this case, we've combined a couple of these. We're in the process of one non-coding RNA binding. You now change the structure of the RNA so that you create the other epitope, the other cis regulatory element. So there's a hierarchy. And this is like the attenuator molecule in prokaryotic operons, like the tryptophan operon, where you've got two stem loops, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 2, 3 base pair as well. This is the one where the ribosome, depending on where the ribosome is at and whether it's stalled or not, you get one of two forms, this or this. Clearly, they're mutually exclusive. And the whole point is, if the ribosome is sitting on stem 1, then stem 2 is able to base pair with 2, 3. And if it's not sitting there, then 1, 2 forms. So 1, 2 is given the chance to form first, and it has to be precluded from forming for 2, 3 to form. So there's actually a biochemical order in which these would occur. Anyway, so that's what we proposed here.
So there's this miR-16, which is known to associate with this A-rich element.
Yep.
Where in this does it?
All right, so this is also what forced me to think about this. It was that paper. There's a paper that came out, and they actually cited some of her stuff, which is why I liked it. But they said, okay, here's this microRNA targeting stuff. And they did this vast prediction modeling of where these are the Miranda people, where all the microRNAs are supposed to be hitting. And they said, well, if you look at the set of messages that are being hit, they were previously identified by us as being targets of an RNA binding protein, in this case the ALV proteins. They say, well, here's the 100 messages that are bound by our protein, and every one of them was being targeted by the same micros. And in the figure they showed where the microRNAs were hitting in and around the AU-rich regions. Problem was, we don't really know what an AU-rich element is, so it's hard to say what these do to it. And that's, I don't have much of an answer. I don't exactly know what the protein binds, so I don't know how the microRNAs would affect it. And so I think their conclusions I'm comfortable with, that there appeared to be a lot of impinging on the same region, that in general this is the AU-rich element region, meaning there's a lot of A's and U's there, and there was a lot of targeting of the micro, and it's thought that that's the general area where the proteins bind. Again, just as a little bit of background on the protein, so the proteins that bind the AU-rich elements, they have three domains. Each one of those domains can bind one of those AU-rich elements. And we and others have data that there's multiple proteins that will load. So you can have as many as 5 or 6 proteins bound to a message, each one binding 3 or 4 of these AU-rich elements. So you can imagine the non-coding RNAs could be affecting it in many, many ways. Everything from just hiding them to changing the shape to creating them. I don't know yet. So we are testing this in the following way. And I'll conclude and take questions. I've gone long enough. So we have taken this. We've taken this sequence and we've popped it into a luciferase reporter, and we express that. And we express that in the presence or absence of an shRNA that contains that. And we can actually titrate in. And so the idea is that we should be able to affect luciferase expression and then we're also taking the lysate, and I'm doing my precipitations. And the argument is that my RNA binding protein that binds this, I should be able to precipitate the luciferase body in decreasing amounts as I increase my shRNA. I should knock out the ability to bind this. And so that's, and we actually have some data to support it. It's not as black, it's not as dramatic as I think we would like at this point. Problem comes in with the amount. It's not a trivial system. You've got a lot of luciferase construct in there, and you've got, you know, you're trying to knock out a lot of binding. It's not trivial. But this gets at the, I mentioned the SV40 stuff, and we can maybe talk about that a little bit later. So SV40 is a DNA virus that uses the cellular histones to encapsulate. So it actually wraps its DNA around cellular histones to get out of the cell. So why SV40 would be wanting to mess with histone messages, I don't know. I can make an argument for, you know, why it has a microRNA that would affect the histone maturation. That's all I got. I'm going to put up my gang and take some questions.
So you precipitate arginine and you pull down non-coding RNAs. And the hypothesis is those RNAs are acting in trans to regulate other mRNAs.
Would be my guess. I mean, with Argonaut, you may be actually capturing the micros themselves, because that's the processing machinery.
Why don't we think that it could be microRNAs which are acting in trans to regulate these non-coding
RNAs? Say that again?
Why? The non-coding RNAs could be the targets of microRNAs.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm using the terms inappropriately because if I'm using them correctly, microRNAs is a subfamily of the non-coding RNA. You know, it's a type of non-coding RNA.
The non-coding RNA is not acting in trans like a microRNA. It's actually...
It's the substrate. No, I'm 100% agreement. Certainly. And I'm an RNA biologist, so this stuff kind of makes me excited. But, I like the idea of this whole world of RNA-RNA interactions taking place behind the scenes that we had no clue about. I mean, it goes back to this primordial RNA world. There may be lots of buttons being pushed by non-coding RNAs that are regulating each other, that are regulating messages, that are regulating essentially the production of all kinds of things in the cell. And again, the problem is I don't know the players, so it's so hard to start defining anything. I mean, we know, whatever, a couple hundred microRNAs. All these new non-coding RNAs, we have no real concept about what they are, let alone what they do yet. But I had mentioned that when we do see activity in the introns, they more often than not are coming from the other strand. I mean, I like the idea of them being involved in alternative splicing, that you've got the DNA is open, you've got transcription occurring on this side, why not have some transcription occurring on the other side? There's actually a lot of data that suggests that does happen. And that you've got non-coding RNAs being transcribed from the intronic region of the other strand that are crossing over and interacting with the nascent message that's being transcribed and affecting alternative splicing, you know, whether that splice junction does or does not get maintained or it weakens or lessens an alternative splice site in the message. And I actually like it from a biochemical. Again, you've got everything that needs to happen right next to each other as opposed to this thing having to find the message while it's being made. You know, it actually is made concurrently.
Why not, instead of overexpressing something with luciferase in the first acid, et cetera, do a knockdown of your microRNA of interest and then do the pull down?
Good question. So this micro isn't readily in these cells, we don't see much of that 518. In fact, I think when it's made in a very small window of time. But that's not a bad idea, actually. That's not a bad idea at all, trying the reverse. And obviously there's technology to do that. You can knock out the micros just as well. I thought you were going to go down a different road with that. One of our concerns is the endogenous histone message, that are we going to affect cell growth? Because if this is actually a way in which these are regulated, histones are kind of important to the cell. So Let me think about that, though. We haven't played with trying to knock out the 518. We should do that. And keep in mind, SV40, I mean, it immortalizes the cell. That's what it, you know, it does. And so maybe that's what we would see if we did that. Good idea, actually.
Thanks.